content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Today's first article is an edited version of an article from the science section entitled "The Real Obstacle to Nuclear Power" by Jonathan Rauch, and this is from the March 2023 issue. Kairos Power new test facility is on a parched site a few miles south of Albuquerque, New Mexico Airport. Around it, desert stretches toward hazy mountains on the horizon. The building looks like a factory or a warehouse. Nothing about it betrays the moonshot exercise happening within. There, digital readouts count down the minutes, T-minus style, until power begins flowing to a test unit, simulating the blistering heat of a new kind of nuclear reactor. In this test run, electricity, not uranium, will furnish the energy. Graphite-encased fuel pebbles, each about the size of a golf ball, will be dummies containing no radioactive material, but everything else will be true to life, including the molten fluoride salt that will flow through the device to cool it. If all goes to plan, the system, never tried before, will control and regulate a simulated chain reaction. When I glance at a countdown clock behind the receptionist during a visit last May, it says 31 days, 8 hours, 9 minutes, and 22 seconds until the experiment begins. The test unit looks surprisingly unimpressive. A shiny cylindrical drum, only about 16 feet tall, resembling an oversized water heater. The scale is unlike that of an existing commercial nuclear plant. Forget about those airport-scale compounds with their fortress-like containment enclosures and 40-story cooling towers belching steam. This reactor will sit in an ordinary building the size of, say, a suburban self-storage facility. It will be made in factories for easy shipping and rapid assembly. Customers will be able to buy just one to power a chemical or steel plant, or a few linked like batteries to power a city. Most important, even if a local disaster cuts the power to the cooling system and safety systems fail, this reactor will not melt down, spew radioactive material, or become too hot and dangerous to approach. It will remain stable until normal conditions are restored. Small and safe is the vision, at least. Dozens of companies and labs in the U.S. and abroad are pursuing it. Kairos Power is well along, with a permit to build a full-fledged nuclear test reactor already moving toward federal approval, hopefully by the end of 2023. As I tour the facility, however, I soon realize that the crucial technology is not 16 foot tall, but about 5'6", balding, with jeans and thick black frame glasses. John Muratori runs this test operation, and as you would expect, is an experienced engineer. As you might not expect, he is a space engineer, not a nuclear one. As a boy in the 60s, he was the archetypal kid who built model planes and joined the rocketry club and never stopped daydreaming about human flight. He spent 24 years working for NASA, where he was a flight controller for the space shuttle program under the legendary flight director Gene Kranz of Apollo 13 movie fame. Then he spent a decade working for SpaceX, Elon Musk's world-beating private space flight company. Nuclear power wasn't on his radar until recently, when Kairos' executives called him for advice and wound up recruiting him. A lot of it was the same, he told me. A launch pad and a nuclear reactor have a lot in common. Extreme temperatures and many tons of concrete, and lots of pipes and valves and sensors and controls that must work together with extreme precision. There's another, more significant similarity. The industry is hobbled by costs and schedule overruns, as was the launch industry prior to SpaceX. Managing complex projects and bringing new vigor to old ideas is something Muratori's 40 years in the space industry have taught him a lot about. Nuclear power is in a strange position today. Those who worry about climate change have come to see it as essential. The warming clock is ticking, another sort of countdown, and replacing fossil fuels is much easier with nuclear power in the equation. And yet the industry, in many respects, looks unready to step into a major role. It has consistently flopped as a commercial proposition. Decade after decade, it has broken its promises to deliver new plants on budget and on time. And despite an enviable safety record, it has failed to put to rest the public's fears of catastrophic accidents. Many of the industry's best minds know they need a new approach. The real challenge with giant nuclear plants like Fukushima and Three Mile Island is not making them safe, but doing so at a reasonable price, which is the problem that companies like Kairos are trying to solve. But even people who feel scared of nuclear power do not dispute that fossil fuels are orders of magnitude more dangerous. One study published in 2021 estimated that air pollution from fossil fuels killed about 1 million people in 2017 alone. In fact, nuclear power's safety record to date is easily on par with the wind and solar industries because wind turbines and rooftop panels create minor risks such as falls and fire. As for nuclear waste, it has turned out to be a surprisingly manageable problem, partly because there isn't much of it. All of the spent fuel the U.S. nuclear industry has ever created could be buried under a single football field to a depth of less than 10 yards, according to the Department of Energy. Unlike coal waste, which is spewed into the air we breathe, radioactive waste is stored in carefully monitored casks. Because solar and wind power are inherently intermittent, they require other energy sources to even out peaks and dips. Natural gas and coal can do that, but of course the goal is to retire them. Batteries can help, but are much too expensive to rely on at present, and mining, manufacturing, and disposing of them entail their own environmental harms. Also, nuclear power is the only efficient way to provide zero carbon heat for high-temperature industrial processes, such as steelmaking, which accounts for about a fifth of energy consumption. Perhaps more important, adding solar and wind capacity becomes more expensive and controversial as the most accessible land is used up. Nuclear energy's footprint is extremely small. Solar energy production uses dozens of times as much land per unit of energy produced. Wind uses much more land than that. According to congressional testimony by Armand Cohen of the Clean Air Task Force, meeting all of the eastern United States energy needs might require 100,000 square miles of solar panels, an area greater than New England, or more than 800,000 square miles of onshore windmills, Alaska plus California, versus only a bit over 500 square miles of nuclear plants, size of Phoenix, Arizona. Given the amount of real estate that solar and wind farms usurp, efforts to place them are running into entirely predictable local resistance, which will only increase as the easiest and cheapest sites are picked off. Finally, as low- and middle-income countries develop over the next several decades, they will almost double the world's demand for electricity. Total global energy consumption will rise by 30% by 2050, according to the International Energy Agency. Meeting this challenge while reducing carbon emissions will be much harder, if not impossible, without a nuclear assist. So what is the main problem for the nuclear power industry? In sum, the nuclear power industry. The U.S. has two big commercial reactors under construction, both at the same site in Georgia. The licensing process for them began in 2008. Construction began in 2012 with a projected price of $14 billion and a startup plan for 2017 at the latest. As of February 22, 2022, the projected cost had mushroomed to $30 billion and the reactors still aren't open. No one who knows the industry is surprised. In the United States, construction delays on the Georgia reactors and others drove Westinghouse, the company building them, into bankruptcy. France started building a new reactor at its Flamanville plant in 2007, planning to open it in 5 years. As of this writing, it is still not ready. Delays and cost overruns are so routine, they are simply assumed. Nuclear, as it exists today, Mike Loffer, the co-founder of and CEO of Kairos Power, told me, is clean, it's reliable, it's safe, but it's not affordable. And that's what's holding nuclear back from a much bigger role in fighting climate change. In September, I joined a Zoom call to check on the progress of Kairos Power's simulation experiment in Albuquerque. I saw the control room I had toured several months earlier, two rows of computer monitors facing a bank of screens that show video feeds and data streams. Besides John Moratori, only two operators, a test director and a test engineer, were in the room. Dozens of other engineers and executives monitored their proceedings from afar. The test didn't present much of a spectacle. In August, electricity had begun flowing into the shiny drum that mimicked an advanced reactor. Inside the simulator, hundreds of sensors dispatched data to the control room as the core's temperature rose to the levels of a nuclear reaction. That day, it measured almost 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit. Yet, according to Moratori, the test unit was cool to the touch. At that high temperature, he told me, the system had been stable for several days. Early in 2023, after the hardware passed muster, salt would be introduced for weeks of evaluating and tweaking. With the results in hand, the company would begin construction of its full-fledged test reactor with live nuclear fuel in Oak Ridge, the same place that the previous U.S. experiment with a salt-cooled reactor had been conducted back in the 1960s. What's old is new again. Or rather, to be more precise, what is newest and potentially most significant about Kairos' test is not a technological invention. Rather, it is innovation more broadly conceived. First and foremost, Kairos is devising not a nuclear technology, but a business technology, a method of organizing a very complex project to be faster, simpler, more efficient, and cheaper. This kind of process innovation may not look like much, but it's what nuclear power needs if it is to fulfill its extraordinary promise. As my virtual tour wound down, I asked to meet the test director. Up from behind a monitor popped Davis Libby. When I asked about his background, he said he was a recent recruit from, I should have seen this coming, SpaceX. John Moratori had snapped him up just a few months earlier. Apart from having to deal with very hot rather than very cold temperatures, he said, switching from spaceflight to nuclear power had been seamless. From a control room standpoint, this is very much what you'd see in South Texas or Hawthorne, he said, referring to a SpaceX launch site and its headquarters in California. It's all very similar. For the sake of the nuclear industry and the planet, we need to hope so. Our second article is entitled, Why Adults Still Dream About School, by Kelly Conaboy, and this is from September 2022. I have a recurring dream. Actually, I have a few. One is about dismembering a body. I'd rather not get into that. But the more pertinent one is about college. It's the end of the semester, and I suddenly realize that there is a class I forgot to attend, ever. And now I have to sit for the final exam. I wake up panicked, my GPA in peril. How could I have done this? Why do I so consistently self-sabotage? Oh, then I remember I haven't been in college in more than a decade. Some with intimate knowledge of my academic career might point out that this nightmare scenario is not that far removed from my actual collegiate experience, and that at certain times in my life it did not take the magic of slumber to find me completely unprepared for a final. And well, regardless of what may or may not have been true of my personal scholastic rigor, I suspect the school stress dream is quite a common one, even among nerds. Deidre Barrett, a dream researcher at Harvard University and the author of Pandemic Dreams and The Committee of Sleep, confirmed my suspicion. She rattled off a few common school dream variations. The dreamer has to rush to an exam after having overslept, or they can't find their classroom, or they prepared for an exam by studying the wrong subject, or they sit down for an exam and the text is in hieroglyphics, or they show up to school nude. It's a really common theme, she told me, and it's common not only for people who are still in school, it's a very common theme for people who are far into adulthood, who have been out of school forever. Barrett explained that these dreams tend to pop up when the dreamer is anxious in waking life, particularly about being evaluated by an authority figure. She's found that people who wanted to act or play music at an early age tend to experience anxiety dreams, not about school, but about auditions in their youth, that was where they interacted with authority figures who could most easily crush them. In each of these dream scenarios, we revisit the space where we first experience success or failure based on our performance. To find out what my specific performance-based anxiety dream means, I went to see Jane Teresa Anderson, a dream analyst and the author of The Dream Handbook. Although science is undecided about the exact purpose of dreams, Anderson believes that dreams are the result of your mind attempting to process memories, both conscious and unconscious. Aspects of your past might come up in a dream to help you categorize new experiences, even if you aren't conscious of the connection, and maybe, as Anderson put it, to wake up with a new shifted mindset. What might be that dream scenario that you've picked up, being back at school and having to take this final, she told me, is feeling tested in life, feeling that you have to respond to other people's expectations, and feeling that I'm not meeting those expectations. So you think back to school. Certainly we feel tested by people other than teachers throughout our life. Our bosses, maybe the IRS. The reason school dominates as a go-to anxiety setting, Anderson said, is because school is where we build our understanding of how life works. So much stuff happens in school that it really sets your foundational beliefs and really sticks there in your unconscious mind, she said. Feelings of stress, inadequacy, embarrassment, heartache, these often happen first in the school setting. It can be very hard to shift those beliefs, she said. But the system of beliefs ingrained in us starting at age 5 or earlier may not be really applicable to adult challenges. Knowing that can be helpful in separating reality from the feelings that lead to school-themed anxiety dreams. You can go back and say, well, when I was 15, I was a different person, but I know it was the expectation of my father that I do well on my tests, Anderson said. Am I now still actually responding in life as if my father is expecting me to do well? Too real, Jane Teresa. But I was curious about whether there is also a primal reason for why people remained enrolled in night school until death. My guess at the evolutionary purpose behind these dreams, reminding aging dreamers that being young was actually not that fun. But Barrett has a different theory. It's about what was important to survival. Obviously, in terms of evolutionary history, the amount of time that students spend in classrooms is a blink of an eye. But the experience of learning skills from authority figures who might increase our chances of survival is much older. Even though physical survival is not necessarily a question for many people, certainly what is taught in school are skills that are necessary to do well in life, Barrett said. If feelings of inadequacy prompt you to have an anxiety dream, and if that anxiety dream prompts you to study harder, you might just have a better chance of surviving AP calculus or a big work presentation. That, Barrett said, has an evolutionary purpose. Still, if you'd like to defy evolution and finally graduate from dream school, Anderson has a method. First, make the connection between the events in your dream and recent events in your life so that you can learn something about what you're feeling and more easily let it go. Then she said, you revisualize a positive ending. Immediately post-dream while you're lying in bed, imagine the dream scenario again, but this time with a more calming outcome. The example she gives is a teacher telling you that you've already passed the class. You don't need to do this, they might say. You're fine. And although that seems to be just changing the outcome of the dream, Anderson said, it will actually change your mindset, whatever the situation is in your life that you're responding to. Well, it's worth a shot. You don't have to take a final right now, I'll envision my professor saying. And, by the way, you can stop dismembering that body. Next, from the family section, why are toy commercials still like this? Plenty of modern parents want their kids to play with whatever they like, but in ad world, dolls are for girls and trucks are for boys. This was written by Stephanie Thompson and is from January 2023. Last month, I ran a tiny media experiment in my own home. I recorded all of the toy commercials that my 3-year-old daughter watched in a 1-week period, looking for patterns in how she was being advertised to. What I saw in those 28 ads was like something dreamed up in a Mad Men era boardroom. Girls preparing plastic food, boys gripping monster-themed action figures. Researchers told me that such gendered toy marketing shapes how kids play and what they learn. Across the roughly 8 hours of content we watched together, all of it Nickelodeon programs aimed at kids 2 and older, 68% of the toy commercials foregrounded either only girls or only boys playing with the product. The all-girl commercials tended to use pastel colors, or pinks and purples. They mostly advertised dolls and plush toys, and the products, and products related to beauty and fashion. The all-boy commercials, in contrast, drew on colors such as yellow, green, red, and blue. Many of them promoted toys based on characters from video games. A Mario action figure, for instance, was tasked with rescuing Princess Peach. Or toys related to transportation or adventure. About 32% of the ads featured both boys and girls, but even some of those relied on lazy gender stereotypes. One advertisement for a kid's camera showed boys playing with a blue version and girls playing with a pink one. This clear gender divide doesn't reflect how my daughter actually likes to play. Her Christmas gifts included a pop-up soccer goal, a Spider-Man costume, and a purple, sparkly unicorn dress. And she loved all of them. Rather than limiting her to conventional girls' toys, baby dolls, pink play ovens, tea sets, my husband and I let her form her own tastes. This isn't a heroic or even unusual stance. In one 2017 Pew Research poll, 76% of respondents said that it's a good thing for parents to encourage their daughters to play with toys associated with boys. 64% said the same about encouraging boys to play with toys associated with girls. But toy companies apparently haven't gotten the memo. Admittedly, my analysis isn't very scientific. It only shows what one toddler saw in a given week. It doesn't take into account the chaotic advertising environment where many kids now watch programming, YouTube. In some ways, toy marketing is less gendered now than in the past. Big box retailers such as Target are doing away with pink and blue toy aisles, and brands such as Disney no longer explicitly categorize their products as for girls or for boys. But researchers told me that many toys are still packaged and marketed using implicitly gendered cues, and kids still pick up on these associations. Lisa Dinella, a psychology professor at Monmouth University who researches toys and gender, put it this way. If a kid watches a commercial where a little girl is nurturing a doll and there's not a boy to be seen, that's sending them a message that this toy is for girls. I certainly don't mind my daughter playing with toys that are stereotypically associated with girls. I wouldn't want to overcorrect and deprive her of the fun and learning these toys offer. But I hope that when she uses them, it's not at the expense of all other toys. Really, I just want her to be able to decide how she plays without excessive influence. I want that for all kids. After all, decades of early childhood development research have shown that a toy isn't simply a toy. Play leads to learning, and learning leads to life choices, Dinella told me. So when entire categories of toys feel off-limits to kids of a particular gender, they are denied the developmental opportunities those toys provide. Boys, for example, are more likely than girls to play with building blocks and puzzles. And research suggests that that kind of play might be linked to gender differences in spatial abilities. Girls, for their part, are more likely to play with toys such as dolls, which may be associated with social skills like comforting, skills that most parents would want to foster in their children, regardless of gender. Even parents of very young children can use that approach. I told Brown about one particularly irksome commercial for a toy nail salon that featured tween girls in pink and sequins. Just a few weeks before we watched it, my nephew had proudly showed me his multicolored nails to my daughter. Now I wondered, would she think nail painting wasn't for him? She's at a formative age, just starting to pick up on the concept of gender. But Brown reassured me, you don't need to have a conversation about the patriarchy with a three-year-old. She suggested just slipping in short statements at opportune times. I could have said, for instance, I bet boys would also like to paint their nails. Plenty of parents, she pointed out, already take little moments to introduce their kids to big concepts. Kindness, respect, resilience. Grown-ups can also provide antidotes to harmful marketing messages in microdoses to help kids understand the world in which they're living. Now, an ode to pull-ups by James Parker from November 2022. Who do I think I am dangling off this bar? I think I'm an ape. I think I'm an aerialist. I think I'm Jason Momoa. I think I'm a 54-year-old man with a dodgy shoulder, experiencing, to the pound, to the ounce, the precise terms of my contract with gravity. That's one thing you can always say for the pull-up. You're lifting your own weight. Its first cousin, of course, is the push-up. But with the push-up, has no verticality. A blur of ground or of floor bounces madly back and forth in front of your face. And besides, your feet are taking up some of the load. So as far as body weight goes, that means you're bearing, just Googled this, only 64%. No, for the true self-haul, the full load of who you are, it has to be the pull-up. You could do pull-ups alone, very alone, but maybe a couple of your pull-up brothers are there too, grimly contemplative, walking in loose circles around the bar, shrugging and sighing. Pull-up talk is minimal and poetic. The other day I asked a big dude if I could jump in between his sets. He took out one earbud and, as I repeated the question, get at it, he said, get some. Are you wondering how many I can do? I can do 8. I can do 60. I can do 102. In 13 sets over a period of 2.5 days. Sets of 9, sets of 4, sets of naught. As for technique, I've invented my own grip. I call it the French press. The point is, I do them. I do pull-ups, and they never get any easier. Still the same flurry of dismay as I stare up at the metal bar. Still the same sensation of wretched brain cells as I jump and grab and heave. But the pull-up cures me like no other exercise. It lifts me clear of my stews and stagnancies. It dramatizes my rising above. Need a mood shifter, a circuit breaker? Do pull-ups. And do them outside. Nothing against gyms or the pull-up bar in store installed over a doorway at home. But for the real pull-up effect, you want to be hoisting yourself into the sky. At the moment of maximum effort, you want to be silhouetted against infinity. Then you drop to the earth, the sturdy and ever-supportive earth. There it is, and there you are, ready. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5100.